It can be hard to know what the best route to take is when it comes to your brand packaging, especially if you want to stand out on the shelf and create a connection with your audience. Today, we're joined by Michael Keplinger, partner of Smash Brand, and he explains how you can use market research and testing to create packaging that delights your audience and builds your brand. Welcome to the Unified Brand Podcast, brought to you by Elements Brand Management, a weekly brand building and brand strategy podcast to help you unlock your brand's potential, stand out from the competition, and create impact. Today, we're joined by Michael Keplinger, partner at Smash Brand, an agile brand strategy agency for consumer packaged goods that specializes in a complete approach to market research, product design, and testing. Great to have you on the Unified Brand Podcast, Michael. It'd be good to learn a little bit more about yourself, what you do, and Smash Brand.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here. Yes, so as you mentioned, really, we are a very strategy-focused branding agency that's really honed in on what works in the consumer market. Consumer products, you know, specifically packaged goods, things that have typically have a packaging all on it always, and how do you perform? And really, a kind of the basis of everything we do is about performance over, say, style. Not that those two can't coexist, but I think traditionally the industry is really focused on, even if you come up with a great strategy, but at some point you move into design and you've got a few small stakeholders that are basically voting on what they like, and it's quite removed from what actually performs and matters to consumers. And so we've really taken this model and turned it upside down and really applying smart principles, but testing along the way so that we get that consumer insight. We are validating. And really, ultimately, I think what we offer our clients who have products and who are bringing things to the market in a very crowded space these days, a lot of reduction in risk and a lot more confidence that what they're doing is effective so they can move on to really the activation stage and bring it forward. So you asked a little about my background and probably why our agency and our process is a bit unique. I actually am not a designer and probably for most of my life didn't really think of myself as much of a creative in an art sense. I went to school for engineering and my business partner, Kevin, and I have owned several businesses over the last 20 years. I've been an entrepreneur for over 20 years and we've owned consumer brand, consumer products. I think in an early career, or I guess early part of being an entrepreneur there is really Kevin being that marketing and kind of creative side and me being more the operational and finance and leveraging that engineering. And I think really what it was I took a break from that and went back to school full-time about 10 years ago and to University of California and business school. And surprisingly, got very, very interested in marketing. And from an angle and a perspective of a bit more about consumer psychology and consumer behavior. And since we still own consumer product brands, really applying my experience from having brands already a full decade before that as well, and applying that really to how do you grow these brands? And we were in the process of kind of a rebrand and shifting things to deal with some changes in the market, changes in trends, changes in competition, which, you know, brands face all day and every day. And through that was really born this, the early kind of inception of how we now apply this to clients and integrating kind of the creative side and ideas, which really do matter in the marketplace with consumer insight. I guess in the tech world, that they call that product market fit, where you're able to iterate and put features out there and find what people care and change. But you just can't do that on the shelf with a physical product. You almost have to put that best foot forward. And so we've mimicked some of that in our process. So today, now that's the basis of how Smash Brand, kind of our philosophy on how we bring products to market.
That's really cool. So I think it's interesting you said that there's a background in engineering, because I think effective branding, one of the reasons we call it the agency Elements is because it's about bringing things together. I think bringing things together and putting something together that becomes something else, like bringing those elements together to build something new, essentially. And I guess that having the engineering background has allowed you to sort of see things from that point of view of how you can piece things together and build something, as opposed to a lot of times if you get stuck in that creative vein, it's creating something and you can get focused on the detail as opposed to being a bit more overview of a plan maybe and a structure. Would you say that's fair to say?
I think it is fair to say. And really, as I think about that and agree with you and maybe adding to that is, I really wouldn't say that human behavior is any different today than it was 30 years ago. But what is different is what's available to us. And what I'm getting at really is, I think if you think about art historically and creativeness, that the meaning of it can almost, strictly speaking in art, right? Meaning can be the whatever the meaning that the artist brought to it. And, you know, we're trained that if you see it the way they do, then you're inspired, you know, you have this vision. But ultimately, when you flip it all the way to the other side in engineering, we're not just creating things that are inspiring and look good, but they actually have function, right? And they have to work. So the scrutiny, I think, for an engineer is higher to think about designing something and building something that, you know, much like an artist would do, is comes out of nothing. And that's how I think brand strategy, really good brand strategy, is, as I've always said, and you probably can relate to and agree with, is that I think the formation of a strategy comes from looking at all these different pieces that are seemingly unrelated and putting them together like a puzzle. And then it's this aha moment, you're like, I got it. And this is all why it's going to work. And I really do think that there is a lot of parallels to that's how an engineer thinks about making a product or designing a solution as well.
Definitely. I think you're right there. I've got a bit of a background in web development and web design as well. And that kind of thing is a similar thought process in that as well. And also it's about brand strategy. If, like you said, imagine a puzzle. And it is when you put that final piece down that you suddenly see the whole picture. And I think it is, as you're going through a strategy process, you're generally collecting information that starts to build this puzzle, that things start to become clear, then you have that bigger picture that you can draw upon. And you mentioned as well, which was really interesting, about the testing side of things. So testing the product, you said product market fit, how they do it in sort of from a tech point of view, but it's interesting. So how does that process kind of work with taking a product to market?
Well, I think maybe it's helpful to kind of set the stage and just, I'll try to do really quickly, maybe 60 seconds, just lay out our process, because then I think it makes it easier to have a discussion about how testing fits into that. But similar along the lines of talking about how, you know, we're very purposeful and strategic, not just the brand, but on everything. And so early up front, and then also, of course, where testing comes in play here is that we have a strong belief and philosophy in really trying to talk to consumers. It's easier to do today than it ever was before, but you still have to be very careful about how you go about it. And so in the branding phase, which I won't get into, which we really just think about, it's like, what's your position? What's that conceptual place? We may use consumer testing, although I tend to call it more of a study, because it really is an immersive study into trying to validate some of these ideas. So there's a place for that there. And then because we are working specifically on packaging, and because we have this really kind of break it apart into pieces and thinking about the puzzle, like what is that job that that packaging has to do? And it's all about the journey of the customer through that. And so while we're talking about on the shelf, so that category entry point, and the shelf today is just as much virtual, Amazon, online, as it is in the store, which I think the store is never going to fully go away for some products. And so we believe that getting your attention, right? It's very crowded, and standing out is actually more important at that moment in time, in that place of that customer journey, than even what you stand for and even what your strategy is. You actually have to earn the ability to grab their attention, their mind share, for whether it's just for 3 seconds. And so this is actually where, of course, everything that you design and the visuals and the placement and all this stuff matters quite significantly in your ability to do that, but you also have to do it in a way that's aligned, that's ultimately those same visuals that are grabbing attention also must communicate your strategy and your position and all these different things. And so testing along these ways is very valuable, that we're able to say, bring forward some really early, even before we have concepts, what we call style frames. So it's a bit more than a mood board. It's a piece of the brand. It's, you can feel it, and putting it out there, and are able to actually measure what is grabbing that attention, what's grabbing that mind share. And then also, you know, what is aligned with that brand strategy that we're working towards. So we have these very functional pieces of backed by consumer insights about what's working. And so it allows us to kind of move towards, okay, now I've got that 3 second mind space, and, or I've got your attention, and what can I communicate rather quickly about, you know, what is this? Why should I care? What's in it for me? And which is essentially your differentiators and your value proposition and positioning, is your brand positioning. The strategy is all kind of how those pieces come together. But another thing that we can test and actually measure what different pieces, because you have such limited real estate there about what you can communicate and how much you can do. And there is very much a yin and a yang. You try to improve one thing at a detriment of the other. And so there's a balancing act, and we kind of move into a second round of testing here. Again, consumers, what's working, what's not, what are the visuals that are communicating, you know, maybe through a combination of subtle words and visuals. And so many examples, because we've been doing this so long, where colors and arrangement and white space can communicate, you know, health, a stronger health or premiumness. And so these are the kinds of attributes that are really the purchase drivers, whether they're subconscious or overtly. We tend to focus on what are the words that are really functional on a lot of products, but there's these subtle nuances of how they all come together that are actually communicating at a higher level. So we take that, and then we're able now, really enabled with rich, very, very rich consumer insight on what works, what communicates, to essentially come up with a thesis of, say, two or three products that are shelf ready, a thesis really about what will work, what will perform in that marketplace. And then that final round is to actually put it to the test where we bring top competitors in, mimic that buying experience, and actually see what performs and learn. And now you've got a process that is typically historically very subjective, and it's very driven by data. It's still very intelligently done. It's still aligned with a strategy and validated that it is. And you can go to market with a packaging that is essentially shown and essentially proven to perform on the shelf against those competitors. So that's how we bring the consumer insights into there, and fresh set of targeted consumers along the way through obviously a lot of kind of tools and process that we've built over the years to do that. But that's how we use the consumer insights in the testing.
That's a really interesting process. So, I mean, StyleFrames is something that we use as well with our clients, and they provide a really good way to get that visual side of things across and that feeling across without having to go through multiple iterations and choosing some different two or three different avenues that they can go down. I definitely can say how good they are for that process. But what I really liked what you're talking about was the product drivers and how that you match the product driver with potentially how then the design feels and how it gets across. Because I think that's something that maybe a lot of people don't realize is actually something that you can do with the design as well, and how you've used the packaging. So we're working on a brand at the moment, and one of the drivers is to do with security and safety. And I think that you can get that across in design. So it'd be interesting to see how you, those product drivers, how you ascertain those or where you draw those from. Is that again through sort of customer surveys, or is that something that is worked on with the brand initially to pick a couple and try that route?
Yeah, that would be closer to really on the strategy side of things, where you look at the marketplace, you're auditing what competitors do, depending on how close of competitors or substitutes, right? You're solving a problem, and ultimately that problem is being either solved or ignored by people, consumers today. And I think a lot of brands try to just look really close at direct competitors, and they maybe miss the bigger picture of all the ways that consumers or people solve a problem. And so I think that's the key of it, is the problem that you're solving, and it will tend to look wider. And what's going to come from that really is the associations that people make. And it's really important actually to drill out. And this is where consumer insights and direct consumer testing, and the idea is to form a theory, right? A hypothesis about what matters to consumers and what the breadth of it, and then use the consumer testing to validate that. Some of those things are table stakes, right? You better do it or you're just not included. You're not part of the decision set. If I have a celiac disease and you sell bread and it doesn't say gluten-free, I just don't consider it, right? Because that's table stakes. Some things are important to communicate. And essentially define the category of minimum criteria that the customer is looking for. What you might find, we find often, is that a lot of brands waste this very, very valuable real estate communicating things that they think are table stakes that actually don't matter. They might not matter for more than one reason. One reason is just because they actually don't care about it. But more often is that a category has been so well defined over time that even if you don't say it, consumers will already presume that it's true about the product. And so essentially you're wasting messaging space by communicating something that they already presume. And you could use that to communicate something else. If you think about it, like, these are all questions, like, we're working on our product and gosh, if I knew the answer to this, or if I really thought about, I can only fit three things. What are those three things that matter the most? Not only that, but what order do they matter the most, so that I might actually, through design, create more emphasis, or actually maybe make this primary point a bit more integrated into the visuals and create visuals that support this to really have it stand out. Because I now know through consumer insights and testing that this matters most to, you know, my subset of consumers that I'm targeting. And so those are some of those ideas. But also getting back to the brand strategy, and you may have a product that is fundamentally, it's not all that different. And so your differentiation isn't about, let's say we're talking about a food product and it's like some amazing new ingredient or this amazing different taste. And there's tons of products that are just very, very similar in that category. And so you have to really move beyond these rational benefits and find the emotional hook. And that's a bit more nuanced, because you're not doing it almost every time. If you really have an emotional connection with the brand, you know, you're keying in off of something that is closer to like an emotional response to things. You almost have to incorporate visual design into this. And so from a strategy perspective, you're defining that. You're like, I've decided in my brand strategy and my brand positioning that I want this perception. I'm trying to evoke this feeling, this response or tying into it. From a strategy perspective at top level, this now becomes a very, very important thing to test along your entire way. And so as you test different visuals and getting back to what you're talking about, the style frames, you know, which of these formed of colors and fonts and feeling and visuals and are really helping to align a better fit to this emotional driver that's important to the brand. And then making sure you don't lose sight of that as a kind of a guiding pillar as you move down towards closer towards final packaging. And so that's how I think there are general practices like a packaging, all products and products that are in packaged goods should do these things. And so these are kind of standard things that we would test for our KPIs, but we're always going to define the brand drivers. And those are specific to the brand and making sure that the packaging, the design, the messaging together, coming together to communicate those effectively and finding varying ways that it does it better.
Yeah, definitely. And when you explain that then, one of the things that came to my mind is something I try to explain when I'm using an example of brand archetypes to people is Haagen-Dazs and Ben & Jerry's. So the difference between the two of them, the brand personality of the two of them and how the archetype they kind of tie themselves to comes through not only in the messaging, but in the visuals. So like with Ben & Jerry's being more of a jester type brand, they have the cookie dough, the fish food flavors, but they also have the kind of comical, whimsical cart and the cows on the front with the speech bubbles. Then Haagen-Dazs is more about intimacy. So Ben & Jerry's is more about fun, Haagen-Dazs more about intimacy and how the cart of the Haagen-Dazs is giving you that sensual kind of lover feeling, as opposed to Ben & Jerry's. And if you switch them, so if you switch the visuals on both of those cartons, then they just wouldn't add up because what you're trying to communicate is completely different. So when you're dealing with the packaging side of things, is that kind of personality and the way you develop those, is that really important in terms of the colors you choose and then how you also, the packaging itself, so in terms of the shape of the bottle and or the package and the actual material used for the packaging?
Yeah. And I love your example because it really illustrates that you can secretly take the ice cream out of one tub and put it in the other, switch them, hand them to a consumer, and they would actually get the brand feeling. So that sense is coming from the brand and the packaging, the feel of that, not the flavor and taste of the ice cream. I love that example because it's really easy for everyone to see that and understand that and almost just know it to be true, which really kind of tees up the answer anyways. Nothing happens in a vacuum, right? One thing that independently acts on it, it's everything that comes together, which really is what branding is, right? It's a whole bunch of associations that people make with a brand that come together that uniquely, like this random unique combination of all these associations that come together. And when you put it all together, and we all have friends that are quirky, and there's like, it's not one thing that makes them quirky. It's like all these things that they do, right? And so that's their personality. And branding to me is very, very much like that. And so you have to think about how all those pieces come together and support it, which is so important why brand strategy and the Ben & Jerry's is a great example because they took a place of this playful jester. And we love the archetypes too. They're so easy to really kind of frame it up. But if that's your voice and tone, that's part of your, and of course, how you talk is part of your brand, right? Your personality, if we think about the person, and then you bring that forward and it almost dictates how they're going to name their flavors. They follow along with that. So all those pieces come together and fit together to build that brand. And so the more consistently you can do that, and it's not just unpacked, but of course the tactile pieces also where, you know, the type of material and the finish that you use, whether it's glossy or has a soft touch finish, really emphasize all of those pieces. And I think that when a brand does that and they don't think about it across the entire brand and all the touch points, because packaging is only one. And for building a brand from scratch, we have to kind of map out the whole vision. We say, okay, here's our vision of what you do. But I can tell you right now that more than half of that doesn't apply on packaging. You have to build more associations so the entire brand perception is guided because the brand's defined in the customer's mind. And so you have to guide them with the right prompts and the right associations, and consistency matters so much. And so all those pieces come together and exactly, even down to shapes and the tactile feels all matter quite a bit.
I really like what you said earlier on about how initially with products, especially you kind of have to get that mind share. You have to initially jump out almost off the shelf for them to latch onto before they can even understand or even get that emotional connection or even understand what the brand's about, because you have to have that initial connection with them. It's not something they're going to come across. They have to go and pick it up off the shelf or they have to interact with it. And when you were talking about that, the thing that came to my mind was method. it just literally popped into my mind, the shape of the bottles, the way that they do things. Always, if I go into a store and I walk past anything Method, I don't have to know it's Method, but they seem to jump out at me. So what are some ways that people can do that with their brand? So how can they create that sort of jump out effect?
I'll build upon your Method example because I like it. And really where I think Method is successful is that they took something that was so common and so almost universally understood as having nothing but utility of washing your hands. Soap, right? Such a simple concept, but then really thought about where this thing sits and where it goes. And what they did was they actually, in my opinion, made something more than just soap. They turned soap, which everybody has, into home furnishings. And I think that the shape of the bottle was a critical piece of that. So let's just say that purposefully you have this key insight that, hey, you know, everybody makes soap. Soap's all the same. Maybe I've got some, you know, real tangible primary data or an Intel report that soap is just people don't pay attention because it's just this thing that we all need and we all buy, like, you know, petrol in our car. So, but then they say, but, you know, I'm going to think a step further here. And this sits on people's counters. And there's actually a huge trend in the market, in the world, really, of design within the home, home furnishings and styles have changed. People buy knickknack decorations all the time that just sit on the counter, sit on the shelf to look good in their home. And so they said, hey, I have an idea that I'm going to make soap, which we need anyways, and has to be on the counter, into also something that might be akin to home furnishings. And so what they did was they created a paradigm shift in the way people think about the product. And of course, let's say before they even got to choosing their bottle, if that is your strategy, it's like, hey, I can't use the same bottle because it doesn't look like a home furnishing. It needs to actually be beautiful. And so the tear-shaped bottle with the very minimalistic design and the colors of the soap so that they can match decors within homes, and people are choosing the soap not by the scent it gives, but by the color and how it matches in their bathroom or kitchen. And so the parallel there and the way of thinking about it is you can always go back, and it doesn't matter if you're a brand new product trying to, you know, disrupt a long list of really crowded competitors, or if you're this old brand that is losing shares to those same people, is just rethinking, because trends always change. And how can I rethink about the problems that we solve? And in the case of Method Soap, it's essentially two problems that they put on top of one product, and it solves two problems in one. So it's almost an instant success if they do that right. But I think that you can find things like that in just almost any product category.
Yeah, definitely. Another one that jumps to mind when you talk about that and how they change things up was, I don't know if it's in the US, but Grenade, which is kind of a workout supplements essentially. But initially they started off with this thing that was to, I think, increase your metabolism, like tablets to increase your metabolism. And it was in a shape of a grenade. So like an actual grenade. And it was in health food stores and stuff like that. And as a young person who's interested in working out, you go in there and as a male see the grenade and you think, wow, that looks really cool. There's a grenade. But it was just such a different shift from everything else that was around it, that it almost jumped out off the shelf because you wanted to find out what was in that grenade and what it was there for.
Yeah, that, you know, as we go through and I talked about attention on the shelf, right? Standout, we'll really audit a whole category. Like, what does it look like on that shelf? And it's remarkable how many repeating patterns there are, whether they be color or everyone just tends to, you know, because supplements, everyone kind of has the same shape bottle and same color cap. And then they think that, for example, like a workout product that, oh, they're all just like 80% of the market are men that are younger. So let's just make our product most attractive to the largest set. But you lose sight of the fact that there's actually the other 20% are actually females that might be interested in this. And so as you think about how you can disrupt that shelf, like this really grenade, right? Certainly I could probably bet money that there's not another one on the shelf. So you've got that attention. But at the same time, going back to what I said about how all the pieces fit together, it actually also needs to, after you've got their attention, fit into the product and the story and the brand position. So I think the key is finding those things that disrupt the shelf, whether they are color, shape of a bottle, just really custom like font or something that stands out, but it also is aligned with the strategy. Like that grenade, if it was some female, you know, PMS medicine or something like this, it just wouldn't work, right? You caught my attention, but it just doesn't fit, but it fits more with what the product actually did. So absolutely, you know, and with so many brands launching and starting online, particular, you know, Amazon and things like this, I think these things apply maybe to a slightly lesser degree, but they apply the same because we have so much choice, even more choice on Amazon than we might have in a store. And so you've got that, those search results there and the image. And They're very strict about what you can put on that image. It's just the product, just so they're trying to mimic that store shelf environment. And standing out there is just as important as standing out on a physical shelf.
Definitely. So how do you find the category and brand drivers that the consumers care about?
Speaking from a client that we start with them, right? What do they know? What do they think about? Because that gives us the areas to dig in a bit deeper. But to really feel confident that you're kind of capturing it all, it's just spend a lot of time. I can kind of think about this from the audience that whether you've got our product on the shelf today and really maybe thinking about revisiting it, or is there some opportunity to address something? Or, you know, if I'm going to go have a packaging refresh, and am I saying the right things on the pack? And the insight really comes from as much time as you can spend looking at the competitive place and moving beyond just perfect competitors, but the substitute products, like drilling in of what problem we're solving and the tools that we have today to really get at what consumers think about it and what issues they're having, what they like, what they don't like, what they feel that is missing is really readily available through reviews. I particularly like Amazon. The Q&A there is so insightful. Every question on the Q&A on Amazon represents a question that's unanswered by that product and probably also by competitors because they didn't run over and choose a different product. And so there's so much insight in specifically what are the questions that they're asking. And in the reviews where people have mismatched expectations, and it's a lot of kind of grueling work, honestly, but when you drill in there and get it, you start to recognize patterns. And when you start to see patterns come forward and you see the same questions being asked on multiple competing products, I think you're starting to get close to an insight. But beyond that, you know, cataloging what everybody's saying about the products, there's a lot of repetition. So you kind of think about it from a theme perspective and you put those themes into a consumer study and you really say, hey, you find your targeted audience, that you're looking for this new type of supplement that you were talking about. And you've got this list. We use something called a Max Diff. It's a little bit easier for consumers to use, but it really gives you not only the ranking of what matters to them, but kind of a spatial difference. So there's be large gaps like, oh, actually it jumps way off, but these top five things are really, really important and can really help lead to, and some of those that your brand in particular or your product is well suited to solve that problem or that need. And some you might be less stellar at fulfilling that. So you're matching your ability as a company, as a product, as a brand to fulfill things that matter and finding that right recipes of what works. And even if they're the same things, you can actually have tremendous success in just presenting it in a way that aligns with what matters to consumers and just makes you more of an obvious choice to them.
Yeah, I like that. I like the Amazon reviews and obviously looking at the different reviews and the different questions and answers that have been asked. I think that's a really clever way, like you said, to find that unmet need and seeing where those gaps are. So what is it that you love most about helping businesses to develop their brand?
Being entrepreneurs and having product brands. And I will say, I really like that. We actually own three brands that we sell on Amazon, but I have someone that runs the operations of that. And really what works for us and aligns with what I like and why I'm in this business is that both Kevin and I are, we're idea people. I think all real true entrepreneurs, that's why you're an entrepreneur, you're an idea person. And it's the, you know, over the years with your own brands that you own, that's the most exciting part of doing it. And then taking that idea and just like really proud and you're like, I found something that's special and different and people want it. And you put it out there and it's got success. And for us, for Smash Brand and the clients, it's not easy to do. And a lot of people need help with it. And I feel that that's the one piece that we're good at and I like doing. I'll admit too that when it comes to brand activation, once you're all done with that, we're not nearly as good at getting out there and really putting that in front of consumers. And sure, it resonates, but you still got to do that work of getting it out there on the brand activation side. And so for me, what I love about it is that moment when it's like, and it's not always just one, but one or more ideas and they all come together and you've got this strategy and you're just like a grin on your face because you're like, oh, this is good. This is really going to work. At least in our process too, we've usually got some validation from consumers. And so moving forward and a commitment from them and just kind of seeing how it's transformative for their business, right? Their business is to launch this product and the product is no different. But what's different is how consumers will perceive it. And that's the piece that I think is all about branding and doing that. And so to know that this product, you know, they can go spend $1,000 and someone makes a label, right? I can't tell you how many times you probably get that if you do any packaging work, like they come to you thinking that they need a label, but what they don't realize and they need is they actually need a brand and a strategy about how that's going to do. And so that transformation on clients when they basically see something that they didn't even know that they could do, and they're seeing that kind of data to prove that it's going to work, that's what drives me, keeps me going doing it. It's just a lot of fun.
That's really cool. So on that side of things, what do you see are the main issues that hold businesses back? So one of them there you said maybe is they don't, and we see this a lot, but don't realize the sort of the underlying issues. They think it's something, but actually there's an underlying thing that's going on, which generally has to do with the brand or confusion or misalignment. But what are some things that you see that hold businesses back from developing a good brand?
So I'll categorize it as, I'll split people in half. A simple lines of, is this a brand new product or am I in market already? Because the huge thing that changes, particularly if you're in market with some success, is this looming threat of risk of making a mistake and losing what you've already done. And it's real and it's kind of big deal for brands that are already in market. And the challenge, and maybe flip to the other side, and if you're a challenger brand, we all see the success. There's so many products on the market and they all, and not all of them, of course, but there's so many that seem like huge successes. What we don't realize though, is that for every one that's a success, there's probably at least nine that we never heard of and they failed. And so if you're in that camp, you are, I would say, if you generalize, they're not doing the hard work of kind of really flushing out the brand. That's probably what's the nine that failed from the one that won. And sometimes even that one that won, they just guessed it right. And they had a really strong intuition of it. And some brands like Method probably, and certainly like Ollie Vitamins, if they have that in the UK, super successful. That actually was the founder, one of the founders of Method took, so I know that Method did it right, but they really were very, very thoughtful about how they were going to position Ollie Vitamins and come forward. And it's apparent in the success that they've gotten from that. So talking about what these kind of early stage brands can do is don't skimp on it. It's expensive to activate a brand, which means to do the social media, to pay for ads on platforms or to get that slotting. And if you think of it that everything that you do right up front is a huge, huge, massive multiplier of all that other spending, it's the biggest spend that you should have, honestly, because to do it right is the make or break moment. And it's very difficult, unlike software where you can iterate and change quickly, you just can't do it with a product. You kind of have to come out with your best foot forward. And so flipping to the other side now of the brands, that these brands that are winning and really disrupting the existing brands, what they need to do is they need to be just as innovative and disruptive and change things to stay relevant and stay ahead. But they're stuck against the wall because it represents a huge risk. And so what we find historically is these brands and these mid-level brands that are doing well, they have some success, they could have, you know, 10 to 50 to 100, even $100 million of revenue. That's a lot to really put on the line to make some change that could be quite radical. And so for us, that is where I think that we can be very effective, because we can use the testing to really reduce the risk and really say, okay, wow, that's out there. We've had clients tell us, and they're doing really well. This brand, actually, in our one of our case studies is a guacamole brand called Yucatan. And if you look at their old packaging, it is radically different. And they have told us time and time again that there is no way in the world they would have made that change without that validation that it was going to work. And they're quite large in the United States and Canada. And we tested both markets, and they have other brands as well, guacamole brands that they own, and have had similar success by making some huge changes, which if I could overgeneralize, they were marketed or positioned really attractive to a much older aging generation of baby boomers. They've been in the market for over 25 years, and it just didn't resonate with millennials. And so that refresh caught that point and also gave them the confidence that they weren't going to lose sales from their existing base of consumers. And so they got that confidence to move forward, and they've seen a like 3x growth since they've done that.
Wow, that's awesome. That's really cool. And I like the fact that you could do the analysis first and obviously take them through that to reduce that risk. And I think you're right. When you have that established brand in place, there is that feeling of risk. So what would you say in terms of that research and the kind of the analysis that you do, what are the most important parts of it? Is it the consumer testing part, or is it the sort of development of the brand strategy, or is it both together?
To do it right, you want to make sure you're covering all bases. But ultimately, let's just say that you can't do it all. And where should I focus? Which I think is maybe pieces of your question there. And I think that it's one of those things that it depends, right? So some products I think are not highly differentiated in the product itself. And maybe the brand is not really all that differentiated also. And so no matter what you make it look like, at the end of the day, your product is not that special. And you should probably do more work on strategy and making sure you get that right. Whereas other products are so innovative and different and they come out there that they may do better just saying, hey, if I could just get the attention of consumers and quickly communicate this product, I'm going to win. And so maybe they spend more time and we might develop more testing that we're making sure that we're getting that shelf appeal, that grabbing that attention, and then quickly communicating what is already innately very, very different about the product and solving a lot of problems. And so I would think about it that from those points of like, you got to have a good brand, your position, right? Where do you land? Is it unique? And are you really solving the problems? Two, are you standing out? If your product is so new and different, there's nothing else on the shelf, you're already going to stand out. But if you have a very, very crowded category and there's a lot of competing products, you need to cut through that clutter to kind of tell your story. And then, of course, the communication, right? What drivers matter the most? And again, if it's very, very crowded, this could be a very critical piece. And then ultimately, you know, you could flip it if you're like, if I'm really on a budget, I think I know a lot of these things, then maybe you make 5 designs that are really good and you just take them in and you actually test what performs better. And so any of those steps along the way are going to effectively move the needle to the extent that you can do them all, then they work together and they in one stage informs the next. And so it's kind of an iterative process of getting better and better and better improving. But certainly like looking at your brand and where you think at least those 4 pillars, you might need more work or be the weakest is where you could, you know, focus your energy on trying to improve.
Yeah, definitely. A bit of an interesting question or a different question, but I was just thinking if you were to say start again today, so if you were to choose a niche to work in with a product you were developing, what niche would you go into with your sort of experience with regards to the product side of things? But also what would be the first couple of things that you would focus on looking at as you develop that product?
When you say niche, do you mean like essentially like a broad product category?
Yeah, I'd say, or just an industry maybe that you see as being something that you'd look into. And also what would kind of be the first couple of things that you would do in developing that?
Yeah, you know, I would have a person, it would be about opportunity as much because that's one side, right? And I think that we can find opportunity and create strong branding and positioning almost anywhere. If you look at really our, we're not one of those agencies that's known like, hey, go to those people because they're the pet food agency. Because of our process, we can really get in and be effective and really look at any industry. And so the question for me, it would be more weighted not on where I think that this industry has more opportunity than that industry, but I would really approach it more from a company. Am I having a brand isn't all. You actually have to also make the product and, you know, have connections and be able to produce the product and effectively run the entire landscape of the business. And so for us, because my initial roots were dietary supplements, the brands I mentioned, we own some brands, they're all dietary supplements because we know that space. We're able to leverage with more than one brand. We're able to have, this is a separate company and the team that runs that, they were able to kind of leverage a lot of synergies from an operational perspective. The barriers to enter that market are really, really low, which means that there's a tremendous amount of competition. And I actually might argue that it's, if you don't have those core competencies on the business side of it, might not be my favorite one to go for because it's very, very difficult to be successful there. You have to really, really have all these pieces firing on all cylinders to be successful there because it's just so competitive. So I think that really comes down to what is the problem I'm solving and what can I do as a company? Like, what am I actually good at solving? What problems can I actually be good at solving? And within there, that's where I'd really focus because I wouldn't say that I just have one, right?
Yeah, that was more the question was less about the opportunity side of things, but more from your point of view. As an individual, you know, what would you go into and how would you do things? What would you look at first? And I think that's a really good answer, like you said, because obviously the experience you have in that field and the operational side of things that you understand. And I think you're right. Competitively, it is a very competitive market. So having that initial understanding and that background in it is invaluable. You know, it's really important. So in terms of from a risk-taking point of view, if you were to say, how can larger brands sort of compete with risk-taking challenger brands? I know we touched on it previously a little bit. But what's the best way if you have an established brand and you've got some challenger brands coming in, how can you compete with those?
Oh, the ankle biters, that's what we call them, right?
Yes.
Every brand today that's in the market has this challenge and this problem. And, you know, getting back to, you know, has something changed? Or is it simply that, you know, there's things that are trends with consumers that we can't control, right? So the first thing I would look at is there a change here that is within my control? And what I mean is that, you know, the days when you had nothing but top 4 mega brands, and we had 13 channels on the television, and they just jammed nonstop marketing to us. So that's the only brand that was fresh in our mind, and they controlled the marketplace with strong brands and strong visuals mattered less then, right? So they just kind of jammed in there. That has all changed. And so consumers have more choice. And not only do they have more choice, but they want to drive They want to be making those choices. They don't want to be advertised to. They want to feel proud that they've discovered this product and this product is perfect for them. And so I think that from a megatrend standpoint, where I see that changing and what I think has happened is successful brands will probably have a couple things. Like they're going to speak to a more narrow audience because it cuts out the choices that they have because it speaks to the consumer a bit more. And that's, you know, like you see like tribe marketing and all these things of really kind of thinking like that. But at the same time, you're talking about these bigger brands and what do they do about this? So part of it is they have to accept that they're not going to meet all the needs that they used to because there's more choice and there's nothing that they can do about that. But on the flip side, what they need to do and be very vigilant about is protecting what they have and making sure that their product stays relevant and doing it in a way that they don't lose what they've already built, because branding built over time and really the mental share that they already have with people is very, very powerful. And so let's say that they need to refresh and really maybe address new trends and new audiences, but do it in a careful way that they are still remembered and recognized and really kind of defining what is uniquely theirs as a brand. People recognize there's plenty of examples of where brands have misstepped this. Really, really famous one, Tropicana. They lost $55 million of only being on the shelf maybe a couple of weeks with some new packaging refresh. But those are the kind of things that keep them up at night and that they have to be aware of. And so I think having a bit more of a process to go through, ensure that you're doing that is important. But at the same time, you have to stay relevant and you have to stay be forward thinking. And so rather than being reactive, I think that it would probably behoove large brands to have a purposeful branch of their, of the kind of the brand management side that is actually, you know, I would almost say that you could be try to be predictive of where these new challenger brands are going to come through, because that's a recognizing what the opportunity is, what the unmet needs are. And then they won't always fit into their brand, but how can they fit that in? And it doesn't have to be the same products, but they can, you know, leverage the strength of that brand to launch, you know, with well thought out brand architecture, whether it's endorsed brands or just different SKUs within the line will really kind of stay relevant, whether it's from diversifying through multiple products or refreshing their existing ones.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point about effectively checking where those threats could come from. So keeping an eye on that, working out as trends develop or different markets emerge, how they could become those threats. And I think Tropicana is, from the point of view of the Tropicana side of things, I was just doing a video on some of the rebranding failures, essentially, but ones that didn't quite go as well as they should have done. And Tropicana was in that. And yeah, you're totally right. I mean, they changed the packaging and they didn't realize the amount of sort of mind share they had already with the orange with the straw in it and how much that was recognized by consumers, loved by consumers. But also a lot of people apparently couldn't see it on the shelf. They kind of missed it because they were so used to seeing the packaging as it was that when they rebranded, people just missed it and just didn't even take notice of it at all, which was really interesting. I thought that they had this marker so embedded in their mind that they no longer could see that even the new packaging, it just kind of was blind to them, almost like snow blindness. But yeah, so the challenger side of things you're saying there with reminds me of the Kodak side of things with digital photography and how they had the opportunity to go into that space a lot longer, a lot time before some of the challenges that came in, but they didn't move to it. They didn't think it was going to be a threat. They weren't watching, like you said.
Well, I'm actually familiar with, I remember that case study from business school over a decade ago. It's really good too, because I think that actually highlights what they couldn't get out of their own way of letting go of. They were making a lot of money on paper, selling the paper. That's really where Kodak made all that money. That's what happens in these big, big companies is they just can't move fast enough. So they have to be very purposeful if they want to and almost break their culture because it's innately a part of these big, and Kodak's a huge company, or was back then. And that's really, really challenging, but it's so important. And it's the trend, right? You have to see where the trend's going because so many, I mean, I look at LaCroix and I don't know how many people realize that LaCroix had been selling sparkling. And I don't know if the sparkling water phenomenon is as big in the UK as it is in the United States, but it is just taking over all soda pop and everything in colas. But LaCroix had been selling in the market for decades. And suddenly something changed in the market and consumer, and it just became the thing that everybody wanted, these zero calorie and not even sweetened, just completely unsweetened, just lightly, lightly flavored soda water, sparkling water. Now we've got the mega brands in the US of Bubbly and AHA, which are actually owned by Coca-Cola and Pepsi. And it has just been this amazing phenomenon. And those brands are doing really well because they have the distribution channels and they're really well branded that you would, very, very well branded products. But Coca-Cola and Pepsi can get that into every store and every distribution center almost overnight. But LaCroix is still doing really well, but that's a perfect example of how the trends changed and it just kind of happened. If you were paying attention to it, you might have saw it happening, but from an outsider, because I don't really pay attention to that in particular space, I just realize it just seems like an overnight sensation, right? Change in consumer behavior.
Yeah, there's that book, isn't there? That Malcolm Gladwell book about to do with the curve, the outliers.
Tipping point.
Yeah. And in that, where he talks about the adoption of something, how there was a film in the 80s or something that really cemented Under Armour, or in the early 90s, that it was in one of those films, those cult films, where someone was wearing an Under Armour sweatshirt, and suddenly overnight there was this, it became a hip thing with a certain swathe of the population, which then filtered out into everyone else. And I think I did a thing on popular culture a while back, and I find that really interesting, how something can just suddenly emerge, a trend, or something can be seen or taken on board by a group of people, and then it just gets spread through, like you said there with LaCroix. Is that something that you see happening quite a lot? Is it something that you're aware of, or that you kind of look for with what you do?
You know, I think that what you're talking about are things that happen so fast that unless you're looking for it, you might miss it. And by the time you actually get a product out there, and there's been plenty of them, right? But they can't keep up with LaCroix, who was already there, and AHA and Bubbly, they just dominate. So you have to now go to the second wave of actually having product innovation to compete in that marketplace because the brand space is owned. But paying attention to that, and you know, the interesting thing that comes up, and I mentioned earlier on the call that you know, not our strongest suit is this brand activation side of things. But when you have these early trends, you can almost be, and I see this actually, it happens. I definitely don't want to switch our gears and start talking about cryptocurrencies, but there's so many of those that there's been well-documented cases where they going out on social media and actually affecting the kind of the perception of this, say, new coin. This is back when they were doing all these coin launches and really adjusting it. So if you kind of translate that to product trends, I don't think you're going to create this trend out of thin air, but if you've got the early phases of it and you have a product that addresses that trend, I do think this is one of those cases where, you know, whether you're good at it, you do it yourself, or you hire an agency that can do this, but really trying to fuel that trend through conversations in different, you know, social media platforms out there and just kind of getting and fueling the flames. And then your product is riding the trend. I think that is certainly an opportunity to grow a brand. I think you need to have a strategy on the tail end of that when you come out of it, because some of those trends are just kind of in and out really quickly, but it could be kind of a way for a smart brand with a good plan to jump on a trend like that, even accelerate it through, like I was saying, through some kind of activation.
Yeah. Have you seen any brands recently that you think have done a sort of a really good job of doing that or developing their brand and their packaging in the space?
Oh, put me on the spot, huh? I think, you know, every day there's examples. I think, take maybe a little more obvious one because it'd be broader understood, but a good example that I like to look at that not super old, but I think you look at RX Bar, and I don't know if you have those in the UK. And I think it really highlights how a lot of times products come on market and they look to their competitors to figure out what they are supposed to do and then make a quick assumption that that's what consumers want. And the underlying trend in the consumer trend, mega trend, was several things, right? People wanted more transparency in ingredients and they wanted to know what was in their products. They also, you know, a trend of moving away from all these things that you've never heard of. So shorter ingredient lists. And so this is a trend. And then you look at the energy bar or granola bar market, and there's a lot of sameness and there's a lot of convention, I'll call it. And so what RX Bar did very successfully is they recognized the trend. And so they formulated their product with four ingredients. And then they realized that, hey, not only are we recognizing this trend, there's a lot of sameness. There's a lot of patterns that are in the market and we're doing something different. But how do people see that and grab that really, really quickly? And so they broke a convention and they put the ingredients on the front of the package, like something that just, and I don't mean like, hey, calling out, hey, our product has, you know, cashews, or our product only has five ingredients. They just simply said, here's the five ingredients. They listed them and said, no be it. And that's essentially was their packaging strategy to convey what was that made their product different. And it just was the juxtaposition of all these trends coming together with a design that brought it forward in a really easy to digest way. And it, to me, it's no surprise that they just kind of launched to the moon and like super crazy success. And so those are the kind of things that I think brands can think about and try to think about. You know, when you've got the idea, the other side of it is you got to get it out there. And so that's an example of how you can do it on pack and overlay that into all these other things that we're talking about to just kind of get that out there. But I think that's how you can really disrupt this market. And these are the brands that keep the mega brands up at night, and I'm like, where did they come from? How did they do that? It just seemingly come out of nowhere.
Cool. Well, yeah, it's been awesome. It's been really good talking to you today, and it'd be really good to do it again, actually. It's been really good having you on. Where can people find a little bit more about yourself, about Smash Brand, and about some of your other brands that you have?
So smashbrand.com can really, we publish a lot of content, but also, you know, look at some of the case studies and try to find some parallels if you have a brand about how we did it and kind of some of our process. Directly, you know, I can be reached at Michael at Smash Brand, or really the only social media I use in a business context is LinkedIn. Pretty easy to find. Michael Keplinger, Smash Brand on LinkedIn.
Cool. Yeah, I'll put all the links in the show notes. But yeah, it's been really good. And thanks for coming on. It's
been a pleasure, Chris. It's good chatting with you.
We've just put together a weekly brand tip video series, which is designed to help you to unlock your brand's potential and stand out from the competition. And if you're interested, if you just go to elementsbrandmanagement, all one word, .co.uk/weekly-brand-tips, sign up and you'll be delivered a 3 to 5 minute video a week straight to your inbox. I'll put a link in the show notes if you're interested. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to receive more, you can subscribe in all the usual places. We're talking iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher. Please, if you get a chance, rate and review. It helps the podcast to kind of get a bit more visibility and allows us to keep on producing these podcasts. Have a great week. Catch up soon. Keep those brands unified.